good afternoon. Okay, so last time we went through a few more things in x86 assembly. We talked about string instructions, so that we had this case where we could have instructions that did two memory accesses, usually with the idea of like doing string operations, and we had this prefix of rep that repeated the instruction decrementing a counter, well, decrementing depending on the direction flag. Wanted to mention because like this idea of having a prefix to an instruction, we saw the example of like rep move SB is basically memcopy. Something that probably would be a little unfamiliar. And then we also talked a little about segmentations. We mentioned that we have this history in x86 where this idea of segmentation was supported, which was meant to be an alternative to page tables that you learn about in CSR2. And, well, we don't actually use segmentation for its intended purpose anymore. In fact, it's not even supported for its intended purpose, but it's often used for thread local storage. And it has this weird way it works in assembly in x86, which is that every memory access has a segment it goes to, but that segment is kind of extra information outside the address itself in the instruction. Usually we don't specify it explicitly because it's implied by what type of instruction it is. So we use the stack segment for push, we use the data segment for move, but we can have these overrides which change that. And then we started talking about what will probably be our main topic for today, about how executable files are formatted. We said that we're going to look at ELF, which is the format that Linux uses, and ELF divides up executable files into both sections and segments, which are different things. So we have this section information, which is like what the linker and so on use to actually construct the executable. They're the things that are probably familiar to you if you've written things in assembly, like you say .text.data in assembly, and that corresponds to a section with that name. And they're not what we actually use to run programs. To actually run programs, we have these program headers that specify segments via these load directives, which we'll look a little more at today. So before I move on to that, questions about that, any of these things from this? Not seeing any. So some logistic things I should point out. So logistics. So we have the homework due Friday, which hopefully you've looked at, which is meant to like kind of be practice with dealing with assembly. Our plan is to have a second reverse engineering type homework where our intention is to use kind of a more sophisticated reverse engineering tool. I should have that released Thursday-ish. Might need. And we also have a quiz, which will be released sometime later today and due before Monday. And to talk about, so if you've taken CSO2 with me, you're familiar with the quiz system I'm using. If not, I'll do my brief introduction. You'll go to a website linked off the course website or Canvas like this. It occurs to me I should have put my, I should have put my computer closer to this display for this, with the idea of doing this demo. So you'll open a quiz, you can select answers, and when the box around the question turns green, they're saved. You can type comments here, and we will eventually look at them when grading. This is what to do if you think a question is unclear, ambiguous, or miswritten. Please make your best guess as to what we meant and do that. And you submit your answers, and after the quiz is due, the answers will automatically be released along with the percentages of who answered what for each one. And if we have graded your question, you'll see grading information eventually here if there's special cases. So any questions on quiz stuff? Okay, so that's just brief that overview of that. And I will navigate the trickiness of I know the quiz will be out during lecture on Friday. I'm not going to just straight up answer a quiz question, but I will talk about general things we've talked about. Okay, so let's look at, go back to our executable format. So here I have this program header. This is part of the output you can get from object dump minus x or something. And we have these list of directives, including these load directives, which are instructions on how to actually start up the executable. And this is what the operating system follows when you run an executable. And they say how much to load from the file. They say what permissions to give it in memory. These are kind of the intended permissions. Like, you can specify permissions that aren't actually possible, in which case we'll get a close approximation of them. And we can have spaces where we load more in memory than it's on disk, in which case the remainder is zero filled. This is commonly used for like global variables that are initially zero. We just don't store them in the executable, and we say to load more than that. If you run this on an executable, you'll see some more entries in this program headers. So we have comments, we have information about how the thread local storage is supposed to work for this program, we have other information for the linker, we have this thing saying that the stack should not be executable, we have something that called RelRO, which we'll talk a little about later, which is a mitigation for some exploits related to dynamic linking. But you know, basically the process is that we're going to take a, in our executable, we have this program header stuff at the start. It says what to load. It specifies this region of the program on disk. We're going to copy that into a corresponding region of the program in memory, filling in with zeros. And that's the mechanical process that the loader does. And then, you know, that's it. And then, well, we're going to jump somewhere. Don't have that. We're going to jump to this start address after we do that. That's loading a program. Mostly. Well, we're going to realize there's some other steps I'm missing when we talk about dynamically. And I mentioned that this is the format also for not just executables, but this is also the format for shared or dynamic libraries, which those are terms are interchangeable. And the difference with those is that we'll have this flag in the top, in the header information saying it's dynamic and not to indicate that it's not just what we saw earlier, you know, not dynamic. And generally, the load directives will say address zero, but when it's marked dynamic, what we actually mean is we're going to figure this out when we load the program. We're going to figure out where to put it. In this case, this is libc.so. This is like the C standard library that most programs load on Linux. Now, we can also have this dynamic flag set on an executable file, and this is known as a position-independent executable. And on current Linux, this is the default way executables are built, that they're position-independent. So it's marked as dynamic. All these addresses, all the addresses for loading, like, are all not really filled in. You know, start at zero, even though we're not actually going to load this at address zero. We're going to choose some other address to load it. And this is the default, and this is the default because of security issues we're going to talk about in this class. That having the addresses be harder to guess in advance makes it harder to exploit memory vulnerabilities. So, yeah, and I'm mentioning ELF, but there's a bunch of other executable formats. We might talk a little about them for some specific examples, but they work kind of similarly. Usually, they don't have section and segment information in the same thing. Usually, they don't do that. And like there's differences in a lot of the details, but they usually essentially have the same structure that they're providing a list of things to load, where to start the program. That's the key information that's going to be in any of these executable formats. Okay. So mentioned that we load the program, jump to its start address, and you might say, okay, so they're jumping to main. And that's not usually how executables work. And it's definitely not on Linux. And the reason why is that when you write a typical main, it needs to like have printf or other things you're using be initialized first. It returns, and that return needs to do something. And so to make this work, the compiler actually links in startup code that actually runs your main. So if you look at where that start address is, it's not main, it's going to be some routine the compiler provided that actually runs main. Okay. So one thing we're going to talk about is linking, and you've been introduced to linking in CS01. Like this idea, we can have one assembly file that references another. So you write call printf in one assembly file, and you combine that with the actual thing that has printf, and something turns that into an actual call to the correct address. And if we're thinking about static linking, this is basically how it works, that we do this process to combine things and fix up the address in the call instruction to match where it's actually going to be. This is not really the story for dynamic linking. Dynamic linking, as actually implemented, is more complicated. Now, there's no reason it has to be. We could implement dynamic linking the same way, except we do it when we load the program, not when we, build the program. But this is not typically what is done. Instead, they typically actually work in a very different way because it's really important that dynamic linking be fast to start programs. And if we had to fix all the call printfs in the program, it would not be. Also, it's a goal of most OSs that if we have like 50 copies of LS running at the same time, that they all have the same memory. This is a lot harder to do if we're modifying the machine code of each one. So we're going to talk about how linking works generally and look at some tricks that dynamic linking on Linux uses and most other OSs use that are going to change how functions actually look in our executables when dynamic linking is involved and make the assembly actually work differently. So for normal linking, we have to have names and resolve them to, where they're used. And our names, like the labels in assembly, go into what's called a symbol table. So that name is called a symbol, and the symbol table says where the symbols are defined. Like, where in the machine code or the data is this thing? Then we have this relocation table, and this says everywhere the symbol is used. So the idea is that in an object file or some other thing that's we have machine code, but we haven't fixed up the machine code completely. This tells us where to change, machine code. So this relocation table will give us that information. And what the linker is doing is it's going through the relocation table, looking, taking everything, figuring out where it actually is, overwriting the machine code for that piece to make it refer to where it actually ended up. So questions on this kind of little model of how linking works. So to give a concrete example, here's a little function that uses that will need some linking eventually. This is my little assembly file. I have a data segment, a text segment, and I have references to puts and string and main that are going to need to be handled. And if we look at the .o file before we do linking, we have this meta information saying that string is 0 bytes into the data segment. That main is 0 bytes into the text segment. And that I need to put a reference to the beginning of the data segment in an instruction 3 bytes into the text segment. And an instruction 8 bytes into the text segment, I need to put a reference to PUTIS. And if we go back to our example here, this is the 3 bytes into the text segment, is that move from this address of string, and this, that 8 bytes is the address for the call. When we talk about machine code format, we'll learn that there's different ways we encode addresses and instructions. And so this type information is indicating what way the address should be encoded. The linker doesn't know about instruction encoding, really. It just knows what instructions to follow. And as we'll learn, this means that we're going to encode the address as a 32-bit signed number. If it doesn't fit in the 32-bit signed number, you're out of luck. And this means we're going to code the address as the difference from the end, difference from the current location as a 32-bit signed number. Okay, some questions. So if I statically link this, then I'm going to end up with these relocations. And here is, this is another way that the relocations can be output. So this is doing object dump minus dr interleaves the relocations with where they are in the machine code. But that this is this information here. This is the same as this information here, just presented interleaved with the machine, with the disassembled code. And we can see that when we do linking, this gets replaced with the actual values. If we look carefully at the bytes here, we can see that this is the encoding of 4016B5. It's actually encoded kind of directly as an integer. And this is the encoding of 40C0B0. And it's encoded as that offset. It's not even, doesn't have any 40 in it or anything, because it's offset from the current location. Okay, so questions? Okay, so we have this symbol table and this relocation table, and we saw that we don't need the relocations after we produce a statically linked executable. And we don't really need these symbols anymore either. Now, if you make an executable by default, it will have a symbol table, even though we don't need any of those symbols. But as I mentioned, this is not really used to run the program, so we can get rid of that. And if you look at like commercially distributed programs or programs where they're trying to save space, they'll strip that information. It's so-called stripping because there's a command called strip that gets rid of that. And this means that, you know, you'll have an executable without the functions marked. So probably in like CS01, like when you've looked at executables and the debugger and so on, you know where the functions start. That information's only there because of the symbol table. We don't need it to run the executable, and it often won't be in executables that we're interested in analyzing. So let's say I don't have symbols. How can I find where functions are? What should I do to find functions? Yeah. Run in debugger and see where it jumps. Yeah, so that's a strategy we could have. And more practically speaking, like maybe a less not running the program is that we can kind of, you know, disassemble and look for calls jumps, and disassemble probably starting at entry. And we'll talk a little more about this issue later on. So are there cases you can think of where that wouldn't work well enough? Way. We'll revisit this. Because this, if we're trying to figure out what an executable does, especially like a piece of malware, this is actually a concern, right? If we don't know what the functions are, it's a lot harder to figure out what's going on. Okay. So I showed you static linking. Let's talk about dynamic linking. And as an interlude, I'm going to show you strace, which is going to show us what system calls the program does. If you've taken CS02, you know system calls are how the program requests things from the OS. So if I run my statically linked program, there's actually a lot of stuff going on, even though I'm only printing something. And a lot of it's this standard library setup, figuring out what machine we're on, setting up the heap, allocating memory for something, figuring out the name of our executable, you know, loading a configuration file, and so on. If I run a dynamically linked executable, there's a bunch of other stuff going on. So there's this code that loads the C standard library. It opens it up, and it reads from it, and it maps it into my memory. So there's this code that's actually doing the loading at runtime. And you might say, okay, so that's how dynamic linking works, is we load programs at runtime. And I told you the way we load a program as an OS is we look at the load directives, we copy the program to that location, jump to the entry point. So you might say, let's look at the entry point, and we're surely going to find the code that's doing, doing this open. Right, surely that must be in the program because of how it's executed. And if you try to look for that, you'll find it's not there. That the dynamic linking code isn't in hello.exe. And this is because I've told you incorrectly how we start up programs for dynamic linking. That there's some other step we do. So instead, this code is in what's called an interpreter, which on Linux is in lib64, ldlinux, x86-64, and so.2. And the OS will load this when it loads the program automatically. You might say, how does it know to load this particular file? And that's actually part of the instructions in the program. That if you look in our executable file in this case, we have this interpreter program header, a different directive than load, that says, hey, this is the thing, this is something I want you to load for me. It has the name of that thing in that section. Name of that file to look for. And that interpreter actually does the loading of libc and all that setup there. That's where that code is. And so then you might say, okay, so we're loading this program that's the same for all our dynamically linked programs on the system, most likely. What does it do? How does it know what libraries to load for me? And so in our program header, there's going to be a dynamic directive that points to this dynamic section, which has a list of things. And it notably has a list of needed libraries. In the case of my hello.exe, there's only one. It's libc.so.6. So it looks for that library. It also has some other information, like where constructors are. So code we have to run before main starts, and string tables, and other information to figure out what to load and how to link things up. Some questions about this dynamic information. So you have this strange process where this weird hidden utility program is actually part of loaded with our program and reads this section and actually loads our libraries for us. So we're loading the library, and then we have to do the linking part of it. And what you might expect is that in our dynamically linked executable, I'd have something like this. And I do have what a separate dynamic symbol table and dynamic relocation table, but it looks very different. And the reason it looks very different is because when we produce a dynamically linked executable, we do this transformation where we convert our call to puts to call this stub, which has PLT in its name for procedure linkage table. And that stub looks up in a global offset table where to actually go to. Something called a global offset table, which is just an array. And these placeholders, that's what we're going to fill in with our relocation table entries. So we're not actually going to edit machine code. We're only going to edit this global offset table when we want to load the program to point to where puts actually gets loaded. So why did the people designing dynamic linking for Linux decide to do it this way? And this pattern is also used on a lot of other OSs. Well, one reason is that all this stuff doesn't need to be changed at all. So we can just load it without any changes in every instance of our program. So if we're running a lot of copies of it, don't need to change it, don't need to change it from disk. And all our changes are in this little array. And that's the only memory that needs to be mutable when we're setting things up. And yes, it's slower to have this extra indirection, but that slowness is very tiny in practice because it's just an extra jump, basically. Questions about our linker stubs? Yeah?
Is this arrangement optional? Is there a way you could compile to go directly there if you really wanted that?
So the question is this arrangement optional? Could I have the dynamic linker actually fill in my call instruction? I don't know. So the primary problem is that we're going to have, there's a relocation table for the dynamic linker. And you can see that its type is jump slot, because we're filling in a 64-bit address. And we needed the linker when we were doing static linking to do something more complicated. And do these 32-bit signed number or offset from current instruction relocations. And so there's two problems we have that make me not sure you can get this to work with the standard dynamic linker on Linux, which is that I'm not sure it supports those relocation types because it expects you to use this global offset table. The other thing is that we need to make the code writable to change it when we're loading, and it probably is not equipped to do that. Now, you could write a custom dynamic linker that handles all this, so you could make it work if you wanted, but not typically something people care about. They need the extra performance, they statically link the one program that needs it. Does that answer your question? So, yeah, we have these relocation table for our dynamically linked program, and it says in the global offset table, put the address of puts when you find it in the library. And our library is going to have a symbol table saying where in the library is puts and all the other functions we might look for. So kind of our picture is that we have our executable in its headers. We say, hey, puts should go in this slot in the global offset table. And we have our call to puts go to that puts stub. And that's going to be set up in a way where we just load it and it already points there. So there's no modifications to be done to the main part of the program or the stubs. And then that looks at that global offset table entry, and the linker, when we load our program, just modifies the global offset table to point to the right place. So we're going to end up having it point to wherever libc is loaded in the where puts actually is. Questions about this calling process? So something else that's done here is I'm kind of showing this as we load the program and everything's all set up. This scheme also allows us to do so-called lazy linking, where we don't set everything up in advance, and we have the global offset table point to this stub that calls the linker, and only then, once the linker is called, does it fill it in the entry. And this is usually what the initial values of the entries of the global offset table that are loaded from the executable are set up for. They're set up to call the linker to fill in the entry, where the idea is there's kind of two modes we can load a program in. We can load the program in a mode where we fill in the whole global offset table as we load it, when we load it, or we can load it in a mode where we load the libraries, but we don't set anything up yet. We just wait for puts to be called to fill in that entry. And the idea here is that if I have like 1,000 functions I'm using and I don't usually call 500 of them, I don't need to look up 500 of those functions to run the program. And this idea is known as lazy binding. And if you look at what the initial contents of the global offset table are, you'll see that it sets it up to point to this stub, usually, in case we're using this lazy binding mode to run the program. So that gives us how dynamic linking works in a kind of short picture. So questions on lazy binding and our global offset table? So as for why are we talking about this? So one reason is because when you look at real programs, you're going to see at PLT, now you know what's going on. Another reason is that this is relevant when we're talking about exploiting programs, that very often we'll have some way of writing to memory that we want to convert in a way to run code. And this global offset table can be a way of doing that. In particular, if we can overwrite an entry in the global offset table, well, now we have that's going to probably be junk too. So, this is one way this will be explicitly relevant in the future, besides just understanding what's going on, why there's this PLT function in your executables, which would probably be confusing if we didn't explain it regardless. Okay, so questions? Okay, so in my remaining time, we're going to give an introduction to x86 encoding. And And there's a reason we don't teach x86 encoding in 2130, that we use a completely different machine code. And like, it's not, we don't even teach like x86 encoding, but just for a few instructions. No, we don't teach it at all. And there's a reason for that, which is that x86 encoding looks the way it does because of history. So way back, x86 is derived from the 8086, built in 79, which had four 16-bit registers that were general purpose and four special purpose registers that could only be used for certain things. And x86 8086 instructions kind of had two versions. So we had the special cases where we had a bunch of one-byte instructions. So like push AX had a particular byte because it was really common. So that was a special instruction. But for two argument instructions, they needed to have some more structure. So they had a one-byte opcode and what's called a mod or mbyte. This is a really processor for really memory-constrained systems. They made their machine code very compact. So this mod or mbyte specifies a mode, basically, that is two bits. I also have a table on the next slide. A three-bit register number, so we have eight registers, so three bits is enough to specify which one of them. They just have zero as AX and so on. There's some way of giving them numbers. And a three-bit part which specifies either a register or how a memory location is specified. And there's this table here from the Intel manual that says how it works. So our first register is the source is the register part of the instruction, and all of these instructions are something register, memory or register, or something memory or register. And this thing that has to be a register, that's going to be in this 3-bit register number. And the question is, what's the other part? And this table tells you what it is. And you can see that we're kind of have this weirdness in that some of the registers are special, like SI and DI are special. They can be added to things. But other registers, you can't do that. And if you know, you remember assembly, like this is not how modern x86 assembly works, but this is how it originally was designed. So we just have this table, and this says, depending on what the mod and RM bytes are, you go to one of the entries in this table. And some of the entries here have displacements of 8 or 16 bytes. If you have one of those appear after the instruction. You have an 8-bit or 16-bit displacement. So, for example, the out instruction, if you look it up in the Intel manual, you'll see it's encoded as 02, the destination register, which is 8 bits, and r/m for another source register. And the encoding here in the Intel tape manual, they'll write in the table of encodings 02/r. And /r means there's a mod or m bit to encode that information with our register number set to whatever this is. So in this example, we have add CL, BL in Intel syntax. So we're going to code CL, which when we look it up in the table of register numbers is 1. We're going to use a mode of 1-1 to get our destination of being 0-1-1, yeah, BL. So we have 1-1-0-0-1-0-1-1, and this is OXCB. So our instruction coding is 02, then CB. Okay, questions? this encoding case. So for the most part, we just realized slash r means the model n table, and we use the table to figure out what to do about the r slash n part. So modern x86, we know, goes to 32 and 64 bit, and the thing is that x86 maintains compatibility with these older processors, which means that all of these encodings are still supported. So that 16-bit table, the reason it's in the Intel manuals is because the processor still uses that table in what's called 16-bit mode. Now, we're often called real mode, but we can run the processor in 32 or 64-bit mode, and that just has the same basic encoding, but has a different table. So here's the table for 32 bits. And this table is a lot more regular, a lot fewer weird special cases. You know, and we have our register and ANT pattern. And we have to have a special case for what about the index time scale thing, right? That's not anywhere in this table except here. That's what these entries are the index and scale. How does that work? There's going to be some extra bits afterwards, extra byte afterwards to indicate that. So that's how we're going to do two registers added together with a multiplier. Then we have what's called an SIB byte. And if the RM bits of the mod RM byte say 100, corresponding to these, you know, two brackets in Intel's table, then we have this extra byte, which encodes our scale and our two register numbers. Now, 32-bit x86 had 8 registers, so we have 2 3-bit numbers to encode each of the registers. So this corresponds to our, you know, index, scale, index, and base in a sort of the full AT&T syntax we have for memory references. And we can see from our table that if we want to have a displacement, you know, we'll choose the appropriate two mod bits, to get an 8-bit or 32-bit displacement if we need that. Questions? And Intel has this as a table, though you can figure out it's a regular pattern, so you don't really need the table, but they have a table. So this gives kind of our 32-bit encoding, which looks like this. Opcode, we have the mod, the register. Sometimes there's a little extra bit of the opcode in this register piece. And the RM bits. And then we have our SIB, if that's specified by this, and then any displacement in any immediate, if the instruction has one. So let's do a little example here. I want to encode BTSL, this instruction here. Here's the Intel manual for it. We're going to do the 32-bit version, so it corresponds to this line here. So it starts with 0F AB, What should I add after that? Or sorry, I have the wrong line. Whoa, okay. It's an immediate, it's this one. Still starts with 0f80. And the /5 means this opcode part is 5. Instead of a register, we have an opcode. Yes. Should it be BA? Yes, you are correct. I just can't read. So BA, and then we have 2 bits, and then a 5. And then we have our 3 bits for the RM. And then it says IB. Then we have the immediate value, which is going to be the 7. So then we need to figure out how do we fill this mod and RM. And we say, OK, I want to do RAX plus 4. That's going to correspond to this entry here. So we have a mod of 01 and an RM of 000. Questions? Yeah. I know this is indicating accessing memory with a displacement. I know Intel doesn't put it in the brackets. I don't know why. But I need a displacement. And a 4-bit of what, and this is 8-bit displacement, and 8-bit displacement is sufficient. Oh, but I need to write the displacement down. Sorry, I forgot that step. That's important. So then I have an 8-bit displacement, so that's the 4 and then the 7. So questions are encoding. How large are the displacement immediate? It depends on the instruction. So here, this says it's 1 byte immediate. And this says this 8, so it's an 8-bit displacement. If we selected this mod, it would be a 32-bit displacement. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? OK. And then you might say, how does 64-bit work? Because we have these 3-bit fields for our register indices, and we have 16 general-purpose registers in 64-bit. And the answer is we add this byte before the instruction that indicates what to do with that, called a rex prefix. So we have this 0100, and then we have an extra bit indicating first, this W bit indicating that we should take a 32-bit instruction and turn it into a 64-bit one. Then we have one indicating that we should take that the register number in the mod RM field register, what the top bit of that should be. Because we only had 3 bits, we need an extra one. And the same thing for the SIB byte, SIB byte index register, and then for the other register, the one in these r/m, or the SIB base rec register. So we'll probably do examples next time, but this is kind of the overall encoding picture. Now, the main reason I'm covering this is that we're at some point going to want to construct machine code to do things like put in somewhere, and it's going to be useful to have the capability to reason about how do I make my machine code not contain certain things. And so that's the primary reason I'm teaching you this. I'm not going to have us I don't want you to memorize how to do x86 code. I want you to be able to look it up and figure out how can I tweak things so the machine code has properties I want it to have. And also so you know what makes machine code big or small, because that's going to be relevant. So this is where we'll finish up today. I think next time we'll start with a few few more examples of this, and then we'll go on to talking a bit about reverse engineering tools, which will, you know, be something you should use in the next homework.